Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we are pleased to welcome back Bob Fitzwilson, founder and managing partner of the Portola Group, one of the financial advisory groups that we endorse here at Peak Prosperity. I've invited Bob to join us again to share his expertise on how the average investor can design a portfolio around the 3E forces identified in the crash course, something Bob calls the sustainable portfolio. And as I mentioned in my prior podcast with Bob, there is a business relationship between his firm and Peak Prosperity, the details of which are clearly spelled out in the write-up accompanying this podcast at the bottom. Hey, Bob, I'm really excited to have you back on the program to discuss end-of-year planning, too.
Well, thanks, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity. This is probably the most difficult end-of-year planning I've ever seen in my career.
Well, yes, I certainly want to talk about that because I know that there are year-end tax and investment issues that always apply, and we'll get to those. But perhaps we should start with a potentially new and disruptive feature this year, which is a so-called fiscal cliff, I guess. Today in the Wall Street Journal, I was just reading, there's an article discussing that some Congress people are already speculating that it might not be too bad if the issues are resolved by the end of January, meaning the fiscal cliff provisions will be triggered and then resolved by month end or something. What are your thoughts here?
Well, to me, what this is really about is the debt ceiling, and the debt ceiling is really a spending ceiling, and the spending ceiling is getting in the way of more spending. And you know, I think it's really come down to a lot of people believing that the only way to keep this thing going is to keep spending like crazy. And I think the fiscal cliff discussion is designed to scare people, and they should be scared, into letting the debt, you know, there's talk of even not having a debt ceiling. And, you know, I just, call me crazy, but I don't know how that works out. And if you're in a family and one of the family members says they're just going to go out with a credit card and just run it up forever, I just don't think that works at the personal level. I don't see how we're going to do it at the government level.
Well, it's certainly something that I think you're right. A debt ceiling is a spending ceiling, as it were. And many do argue that maybe we should just get rid of the debt ceiling. It just gets hiked almost automatically anyway. But this year, it's got a little extra political football wrapped up with it. That's interesting. But I think, you know, the larger issue is being skirted here, which is how much is too much. And that's one level on the spending issue. And then the second is, listen, how many years of stimulus does it take before you say this really isn't working?
I know I'm kind of thankful that I was born in an era where you could have an honest discussion and talk about these things. But it's like people aren't being honest about what this means. You know, I saw one statistic that said that even if you did away with all tax bracket reductions that were instituted in the Bush era, it keeps the government running for 8.5 days. So it's almost embarrassing to have these and listen to these discussions when they're talking about an issue that extends the government by 8.5 days. And, you know, there was also a study done years ago that showed that the government, regardless of the tax rates, the marginal tax rates, the government managed to collect around 20%. So for most of our history, we'd still be talking about that. And what the problem is that the whole tax collection process, to me, is really a sock puppet. We're borrowing 40% of what we spend, and there's sort of this charade where, you know, the Treasury sells bonds and the Fed buys them back, and so there really is no governor anymore. And so the whole tax raising and budgeting issues, to me, are just have become irrelevant, which is not a good thing.
No, it's not. And there's not a lot you and I can do about the spending except to notice it and observe, I guess, you know, what the trends might imply for investing going forward. But how about the other side of this fiscal cliff, the tax hikes that might come in? They apply to investments, income, all kinds of things. What are your thoughts there?
Well, it's going to be a disaster. In California, we just got a little taste of it with the passage of Prop 30, And it was retroactive to the 1st of January. And I've seen some of the revised estimates of tax liabilities for a few clients, and I think people are just going to be dumbstruck by the extra amount of money they're going to owe. And that's just at the state level. So, and, you know, all these entities are essentially broke. And it's not just domestic, it's international. I saw an article that a woman who was managing a portion or all of the Greek pension funds just said that they had to drastically increase their contributions, and they physically attacked her at the meeting. So I think there just isn't money almost anywhere, and so taxes are going to have to go up. And in an ordinary world, there wouldn't be the taxes, because, you know, history shows that if you really try to overtax, that you get less taxes. But what's very dangerous is that this dissociation between spending and tax revenue, and they have, at least in the United States, we have the mechanism to just create whatever spending we want through the printing presses. And, you know, history is real clear that there's an end to that, and it's not pretty.
Right, and here we are, as you mentioned, spending, I think, 40 cents out of every dollar spent by the government right now is borrowed, and of course it's just round-tripped back through the Federal Reserve. This is just, to me, completely shocking. If somebody 5 years ago told me, hey, Chris, in 5 years, what's going to happen in 2013 is the Fed is going to print as much money in that year as had been generated during the first 240 years of our country's history, what would you think? And I'd say you'd be nuts, and not just nuts that such a crazy thought would be entertained, but that the dollar would be relatively stable and all the asset markets would be relatively stable and everybody just sort of be walking around investing and keeping their assets parked as if this were somehow normal or unavoidable or everybody's doing it. I don't know. It just it feels surreal. I'm going to use that word.
Well, you know, I like history, and I was noodling this morning about these grand ideas that show up throughout history. And, you know, if you're on the opposite side of the idea, you think it's almost cancerous. So if you were King George and saw this founding of the Republic, you would have viewed that as a metastasizing cancer. And probably the people who had been in power up until that point saw it in that fashion. And it wasn't a good 100 or 200 years for the kings and queens. So what we have now is this spreading belief that money's free. There's no people don't know where it comes from. It just comes from the printing press. And so it's like a cancer. It's metastasizing all over the planet. And there's probably not a lot that we can do to stop it. And it just requires, unfortunately, pain and suffering at the end. Now, for individuals, you know, we're just people. There's nothing we can do. We can only do things at the family level or at the community level. And so I think that's what people need to focus on, is just make a list of the uncertainties and the kinds of things that they have the capability to do, and just tick them off one at a time and resolve whatever issues you can, and then just hope for the best.
All right, so here we are facing the fiscal cliff as a first consideration. What are you doing to position for that right now?
Well, from a portfolio standpoint, it's a heavy emphasis on real assets, particularly gold and silver. But, as you know, we also like energy. We like food-related issues, water, things like that, the basics. From a tax planning standpoint, you know, there are a number of issues that need to be addressed, and time is short. You know, some are estate tax issues, some are income tax issues, some are retirement issues. So maybe we could talk about those.
All right, let's do that. So what's coming up? Where would you like to start on that list?
Well, the large number issue. I don't know how big it is for how many people are facing this, but there is this expiration of this 5,120,000 lifetime exemption. So for
estate taxes.
Pardon me?
For estate taxes, right?
For estate taxes,
yep.
And it's going to drop back, you know, what people are talking about, to $1 million, I believe, next year. And so for people that have those kinds of assets, they have to. There is this mathematical decision tree they're going to face about what to do, and it doesn't have to be the full 5 million each. It's whatever excess net worth that they wouldn't want to pass down that they have to deal with. So one decision is if you can do it, do you want to do it? And that gets at the issues, you know, you can if you gift these kinds of funds to your kids, for example, the question is, do you want to give them that kind of money? So, you know, I've had these discussions where somebody's got a young child and they can afford to give the full $10 million plus to their kids. But you don't know how your kids are going to grow up, what kind of people they're going to be, and oftentimes having that kind of money, let alone the appreciation on it, can cause problems, if not for them, for their spouses or their friends. Mm-hmm. So people need to they've got until the end of the month to meet with their estate planning attorney to talk about that. And then the traditional forms of tax planning are do you accelerate or you defer income? And do you accelerate or defer deductions? Nobody has any idea about what the tax rates are going to look like for next year. So you kind of have to make a decision under extreme uncertainty. But traditionally, what you would do is you defer income and accelerate deductions. But if tax rates are going to go up a lot, then it may be better to accelerate the income and defer the deductions when the rates are probably going to be a lot higher. So one area for that is in capital gains. You know, if you believe what they're saying, and if you just look at the arithmetic of the deficit, these things are going to have to rise. And so a lot of people are just booking the capital gains. And I would argue even for short-term capital gains, because the tax rates they have to go up dramatically. So that's an issue that people need to look at, and again, we've only got till the end of the month to make that decision. You can mitigate that by gifting to charity. You can give a long-term appreciated stock to charity if that's something that is, you know, not everybody wants to do that, but if you're charitably minded, that's an option. And there are other vehicles, such as a charitable remainder trust, that allow for large amounts of gift and can generate a tax deduction and distributable, in effect, income from so doing. So that's another option. In general, with estate planning, there are two issues. There are fees and there are taxes. And the fees come from the resolution of estate. You know, a lot of people call it probate fees. And so if you think of sort of a T account on the right-hand side, the fee question, the primary way to deal with it is, you know, common sense, like having well-kept records. There's a thing called a living trust. It's also called a revocable trust and inter vivos trust and all that. It's a living will. And that's something that people should talk to their attorney about, because it's relatively straightforward. It basically just organizes things and minimizes the transaction costs of settling an estate. Sometimes people confuse that with the tax issues, and my understanding is that the same tax issues can be dealt with within a regular will, doesn't have to be in the revocable trust or the inter vivos trust. And the main purpose of it is to minimize the costs. When you go to the other side of the ledger, and that's taxes, it's a really simple question. Do I own it? And so most estate planning techniques are about not owning things, gifting them. And so before you want to do, because there are all kinds of techniques, and a sharp estate planning attorney can virtually give away your entire estate. And so the first place to start is, do you have enough money? And we talked about that in a prior podcast. And we have, you know, proprietary technology that figures out how much is enough. And if you don't have enough, or you're just right at the level where you have enough, then you probably, regardless of all these topics and issues, you probably shouldn't make the gifting. But if there is an excess, then the question is, you have the ability to gift, but do you want to give it, and how much? But most of estate planning is about giving away things in various formats.
All right, and that all sounds very reasonable. I'm sure that anybody who's looking at this pretty steep potential fall off from $5 million to $1 million is got to be thinking about this, because it turns out in today's world, it's not that difficult to accumulate $1 million or more in assets, particularly for people who own small businesses or businesses of any form. And how do you advise people who have assets that are not as liquid? Say, I don't know, I've got a family farm or something like that, and it's over a million clearly, but there's not an easy way to, I guess, parcel that off and hand it out children. How do you handle something like that?
Well, there is a technique called the family limited partnership, and you know, in the right circumstances and properly done, it can accomplish a lot of things. It goes back to the early days of limited partnerships, from what I understand. So people invested in real estate partnerships, and when they passed away, they owned a 1% interest in a big partnership. The IRS position was that the person owned one. You take the value of the real estate times 1%, and that's the value of the estate. And the people on the other side said, no, it is 1% of the partnership, but it's illiquid. And so there's been a battle over this for, you know, probably 30 years, but I think done properly, it does work. And so what you get, you not only transfer in a variety of assets, illiquid real estate is a good thing to put in there, and you wind up getting a discount. So you're not only able to give in X amount of dollars, but you're also getting... You're able to give more money, more value at least, because the assets going in are considered to have a discount. It also allows for control. So the parents, they can set up a family limited partnership, transfer in these illiquid assets, and I think they can still own as little as 1%, but still maintain control of how it's managed and all this. And so, so a family limited partnership can, in the right circumstances, can be great and accomplish a lot of things. But it, you know, it can't be abusive, of course. People have gotten in trouble where they try to take ridiculous discounts and things like that, and that's not going to fly. But properly done, it's a great vehicle.
All right. On the more mundane side of investing, what other year-end considerations are usual for people at this time of year?
Well, we're getting lots of calls about the retirement assets.
Mm-hmm.
It is now on the table. At least behind the curtains, that there are proposals to change things around dramatically, and some as extreme as forcing people to exchange their retirement assets for a new form of retirement, a government-guaranteed annuity. So it's, you know, everything's up in the air. So what's so one of the issues is, do you even fund these things anymore? Had an interesting conversation with a client this week about this. He's putting a small amount of money to fund this year's contribution to a SEP IRA. And, you know, it was his words, not mine, but he said, you know, I'm 70 years old. In 30 years, I'll be gone. So I'd rather have the tax savings now, and I probably won't spend what I have in there. And I thought about it, and, you know, if you already have a retirement plan and it's a large amount, then whatever is going to come down the pike next year, it's going to affect the bulk of it anyway, and so the current contribution isn't that great. But if you don't have a large amount, or if you're not at his age, then you have to consider whether you want to defer income at low rates and have it come back at higher rates, let alone being forced to convert it into a new government annuity. So there is some... there's some flexibility as to when it has to be paid. So what we concluded with his accountant is, accountant said he didn't have to make the full contribution until he filed the return. So he was going to put in a small amount and then gross it up once the final number was in. Another thing is Roth conversions. Booking the income now and means paying a tax up front, but it also... given the rules that we understand now, it means that you're not going to get hit for the higher rates later down the road. But all these things, that's why I said it's the most difficult year ever. Is basically, Congress can do anything. And so there's almost no rule that they can't change. And so the best thing to do is where you can handle it is to generate some certainty by booking the taxes and paying it. You know, I mentioned last time that the healthy way to look at this is that you really are in partnership with the government when you fund these retirement plans. And it's like having a business partner who has a percentage of the account, but also has the right to change the percentage anytime they want. And so at this time, it may be best just to cash out with your partner and say thank you very much. So it's extreme uncertainty everywhere you look. And everybody, you know, they need to sit down. You know, I used to program the tax code for almost 20 years, and it's not a logical thing. It's not an architected program. And so you can't apply logic. The way to do any kind of tax or estate planning is you need to say, if I don't do something, here's the effect, and if I do something, here's the effect. And then the difference between the two is the marginal effect on whatever you're considering doing, both income and deductions. And so there's no you can't approach it from a high-level, conceptual level. You have to sit down with your accountant and your lawyer, and you have to work through the numbers specific to your situation and then make a tough decision.
I know there's never very much certainty when it comes to taxes. However, given where we started this conversation around debt and spending at the federal level, the seeming inability of our current crop of leadership, both at state levels and in many states and at the federal level, to really rein in prior expectations and spending habits and all of that, it seems like the odds of the tax code being amended to increase tax rates and overall fees, burdens, levies, surcharges, excise taxes, whatever they're calling these things in the future, it seems like the chance of those going up is much, much higher than the chance of them remaining flat or going down. Would you concur?
Well, I think it was Friedman that said that taxes are what government spends. And so that's why it's sad. But when I look at all these discussions about marginal brackets and fiscal cliffs, they're just sock puppets. They're diversions from what's really happening. And what's really happening is the transition from actually collecting taxes and having budgets to just we'll print whatever it takes, because if we, and you know, it was, there's a book about France's experience called Fiat Money in France. It was the second time they blew up their financial system in the late 1700s, and you hear the politicians made these comments that if we stop, we have to keep printing. And I think the German politician said that at the end of World War One, that we have to print, otherwise the thing will collapse. And you know, hello, we're doing the same thing, and it doesn't work long term. So for me, you know, we have to play the game and play along, and we have to pay our taxes and deal with whatever degrees of freedom we have. But the big picture issue is that we transition from money and taxes to electrons and printing.
It's the same thing, however we term it. However, I think you've just made a great point, which is that once you begin down the road of printing, I think I agree with the assessment of the French in the late 1700s and the Germans in the early 1900s is the same as the situation we have today, which is once you start down that road of printing, it's true. If you stop, there's going to be an extraordinary amount of pain, if not a collapse of a sort or whatever term we're going to use. But I think the Fed's really boxed in, and they're going to have to keep doing what they're doing, and they haven't disappointed me in 5 years of printing now. And it's remarkable. I don't see any way out of this. So it seems to me that printing is part of it, and governments are going to need more and more revenue as well, because that's just the nature of the beast. So
see, I actually think that's the plan. I think there is a group of people who have run the numbers too. They're not stupid, and when they look, you know, there isn't any hundreds of trillions of dollars to pay for all these promises. And so I do believe that a new currency is in our future, and so the spending is a way to accelerate the end of the current monetary scheme and do a reboot. And so whenever, you know, people or somebody will say, well, we need to spend X hundreds of billions or trillions, and they get upset about that. You know, to me, that they're getting upset at what in aggregate is the plan. They have to push the monetary system over the cliff. That's what's really going over the cliff. So they can do a restart, probably with at least a commodity-based currency, perhaps just traditional gold. And, you know, the vast majority of people around the planet have no money. So, you know, I expect sometime in the future there'll be a press conference where they'll say things like, you know, we're embarrassed about the decline in the paper money, and we're going back to sound currency, and, you know, 99% of the people on the planet are going to say that sounds really good. So the people who are exposed are the ones that have accumulated wealth, and so there is a short time left. You know, you have to, as we discussed before, you have to take care of your health and your family and food and well-being and all that stuff. But if you have accumulated wealth beyond that, you have to start protecting it in ways against that press conference, which I believe is in our future.
Hard to predict when, but I don't know that history doesn't suggest there's really anything else besides that press conference in our future. There's just no, I can't think of a single example where a country went down this path of printing and came out of it with its currency sound and intact.
It's well, in your Madrid speech, you talked about the one country that climbed out of a pit somewhat similar, but I think we're going to be in a far worse pit than even those people. And so to me, it's just arithmetic. I mean, if we're all adults about this, there is no resolution other than we need to do a reboot.
Well, that one example was England, and they had a sound currency at that point in time. They stayed on it, and they actually just went ahead and paid their debts back. They got into a debt hole that was about 260% debt to GDP. And of course, you know, our own is allegedly only at 100% here in the U.S. right now, maybe 80 if you only count the debt held by the public. But when you include all the entitlements and whatnot, the numbers range anywhere from 450% to 1,100% of GDP. So those numbers have never been recovered from things like that. So, well, you and I had a really interesting discussion the other day where you were asking me about my near-term thoughts on gold and silver, which is one way, I think, to avoid a reboot of the system moment. And I was really intrigued with your thoughts there as well. So maybe we could recreate that conversation here for our listeners, because I think it was pretty instructive. So share your thoughts, why you think precious metals might be poised for a run from here.
Well, so we went through this historic period where we've gotten away from gold and silver. We've you know, silver is a wonderful metal. It's had burgeoning uses, and it tends to be used in small quantities, and so it's out there somewhere in the environment. But we've pretty much used all the above ground stocks that we accumulated over time. And so, from what I read, the estimate is there's around 1 billion ounces available, and with the price of silver at 32, 33, any large entity, if they could get it, could swallow up the entire supply at a time that, you know, there's medical uses, solar uses, all this. So, you know, forgetting all the money printing aspects, I just think that long-term, the supply and demand on silver is phenomenal. As far as gold, you know, I believe that most of the gold did go east, like it's done throughout human history. And so we're in this period where the central banks are realizing that they need to have this wonderful asset that's proved for 6,000 years that it can hold its value. But it takes time to mine it and accumulate it. And so I think we're in this phase where I don't expect the price to skyrocket in the short term, because I think that it's in the interest of powerful people to keep the price right where it is while they rebuild their stocks that they've been giving up over the last 20 or 30 years. We also talked about the miners, and you know, the miners are in a tough spot. Not only are their costs going up, but the people that run the countries in which they have their mine, they're a lot more sophisticated than they used to be. So not only energy and labor costs are going up, but just the extraction-related costs are going up. And with the price in this trading range, it's squeezing them. So I think for pure gold and silver investors and for investors in the miners, it could be a wait. But ultimately, you know, once my belief is that once everybody's got the restored levels of metals, then everybody's going to want the price to go up. And so there will come a time when, instead of being in a trading range, everybody's going to be on one side of the table, all scrambling to try and buy this stuff. So there will be a rocket ship moment, but it's anyone's guess as to when that's going to happen.
And you and I, when we were talking, this was 3 days ago compared to this podcast. And at that time, I noted that The Commitments of Traders report out of the CBOT showed that there was record short positions in the commercials, and I noted that those are often actually always associated with a downward price spike in the metals going forward. Sure enough, just a couple days later, there was a raid that started on gold that started at 12:45 a.m. in the morning. Classic time for a big trader to unwind a position if you wanted to use CNBC's explanation for that move. But the people who I know who have exchange data looked at that and said, yeah, that was just somebody coming in and just dumping with an idea of pushing the price around. Thin market. And this is just a game that's been going on. And I don't really think anymore that gold or silver are singled out. I see the same behavior in the oil markets. It happens in grains. It happens in certain equity issues. It's kind of just sort of the game we have going on. And you and I have had this conversation before where you were of the mind that they can go ahead and play those games. What they do is they actually create opportunities for people who are aware of the underlying fundamental trends, because these price movements that I just noted, they don't have anything to do with supply and demand on the markets. They have to do with a trader's book and how they're exposed, and can they make money by really dumping in the futures market but owning the other side of the trade in the options market or something like that. At any rate, I truly believe that, like you mentioned, with silver, with only a billion ounces available, 32 billion, you know, total dollars worth out there, that's less than a month of Fed printing. It's an absolute bargain at this price, given its utility and scarcity even now, and increasing rarity as we go forward, given mine yields, ore grades, things like that. And so I'm just of a mind that they can go ahead and play their games all they want, and I will thank them for these wonderful low prices while I continue my own accumulation program.
So two comments. One is, I was thinking about the holders. It's only like 1% of the people own any gold and silver, I just had this image of animals in the cage in a zoo, and so the gold and silver holders are in this cage, and the powers that be love to poke a stick in the cage to upset them, and the goal is to show the other animals not in the cage that they better behave themselves, or you could be in the cage too. So people need to ignore the sticks coming through the cage. You just, as you said, you just treat it as opportunities. The other thing is that in my mind, if I really step back and look at what they're doing, they are creating money out of nothing. And what they're doing is they're buying up all the real assets. So, you know, they're buying treasuries, they're buying real estate, they're buying mortgages, they're buying stocks. They're buying metals, and so it's this. What really is somewhat disturbing is that they're doing what we and your listeners should all be doing: is getting rid of the stuff that they're printing and playing along with them and buying real assets. Because there's this term called seigniorage, which is the right of kings to make money on creating money, and seigniorage now is 100%. My advice to everybody is do as they're doing, is don't hold the paper assets and buy real assets along with them.
And this is sort of the cornerstone of your sustainable portfolio idea too, right? That, I mean, we mentioned the trends before. You've got food, water, energy, precious metals, real things. That this is an age where owning the real stuff makes a lot of sense. And just let me know if I've mischaracterized that at all. But for me, the idea, if we are printing trillions and trillions of dollars, on the one hand, we have an economy that seems mired in low growth. I have my own reasons for why I think that's actually a permanent condition. And if that's true, when you're shoving markers against the economy, which is money, you're just shoving that just in extraordinary amounts of it into an economy, hoping the economy comes back to life, but the economy can't come back to life. You're just creating the pressure points between which two things exist. There's fewer goods and services, and there's more money and money-like equivalents floating around. That's the world we live in. So far, it's been fairly resistant to spilling over into the real world, but in terms of prices for real goods and services, but it will at some point, is my view. And I don't know if you saw this just came out. Somebody adds up how much it costs to buy the 12 days of Christmas, the Christmas Carol. Right. And this year, for the first time ever, it broke into six digits. Wow. You know, and they said, you'd be surprised. It wasn't the gold that drove it. It was the geese.
That is surprising.
Yeah, because the price of all kinds of all feathered things have gone up just extraordinarily on the back of the food inflation that's happened. So it was up 6.1% over last year. So that's an alternative marker of inflation we might think is closer to reality. But at any rate, inflation is part of our lives, and at some point it will be an extraordinary part of our lives if these pressures I've articulated continue to grow without some way of releasing them.
So a couple thoughts while you were talking. One is that people shouldn't take what we're saying to just be in a bunker mentality. You know, from an investment standpoint, there are always people making money. There are always good businesses around the world. And so what it means is that you have to, you know, not invest in adjectives, as I described before. You have to do your gumshoe work, and you have to find these companies. But there may be zero economic growth, but there are companies out there that will always be vastly exceeding that. The other thing is, in terms of sustainability and wealth preservation, I had an interesting conversation with somebody about a thing called an umbrella policy. And, an umbrella policy is, it sits on top of a person's automobile and housing coverage, and it's cheap because the housing and the auto policies are, in effect, big deductibles. But the person, she thanked me for bringing up the topic and said that's a form of wealth preservation. And I'd never thought about that before, but wealth preservation just isn't about the value of your money. It's making sure that, you know, you're tax efficient, that somebody doesn't sue you and steal it. So it's really even more holistic than I'd even thought about it myself.
Oh, that's interesting. It's going to take all kinds of tricks, gimmicks, and sophisticated approaches to maintain our wealth and wealth preservation, because this has got to be one of the most extraordinarily difficult times, leaving aside some of the larger trends in demographics and energy and the environment, things like that. Anytime you have a committed, concerted global program where money is being printed out of thin air with the express purpose of driving up asset prices, be those stocks or bonds, equities or bonds. It's just with everybody chasing the same yield, everybody thinking there's a big safety net under everything. It's just going to drive your returns down and concentrate risk as well.
Well, I'm never going to give up on the fact that there are returns out there if you just do your homework. You won't get it by standard asset allocation and investing in adjectives and all that stuff. So you really have to. It's a form of it's a bare knuckle fight for your money and your retirement and your future and all that. And people need to get actively involved and educate themselves and do a lot of work.
This is precisely what I had in my in one of the closing chapters of my book, where I expressed the opportunities. I said that the opportunities in your field, in the financial services field, are going to be specifically in getting back to fundamentals. That doing technical analysis, chasing momentum, all these other fancy arbitrage, whatever the glamour trading strategies du jour happen to be. I thought that instead there are diamonds out there. You have to find them. You have to do it the old way. It's got shoe leather involved, and I agree. There are always values to be had out there. It's just we have to work at them a little bit harder and have to find them.
Yep.
Well, excellent. Hey, Bob, we're at the end of our time. I really want to thank you so much. Again, we've been talking with Bob Fitzwilson, founder, managing partner of the Portola Group, and they're just an excellent firm. Bob, you're a great guy. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's my honor and pleasure.